This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Matt Damon, is one of the most popular actors of his generation. He starred in such films as The Rainmaker, Saving Private Ryan, The Talented Mr. Ripley, All the Pretty Horses, and Good Will Hunting, for which he also won an Oscar for the screenplay he wrote with his longtime friend, Ben Affleck. The Bourne Identity is based on a spy novel by Robert Ludlum. As the film opens, Damon's character is adrift in the Mediterranean Sea, where he is rescued by fishermen. He has amnesia and has no recollection of what happened to him or who he is. His only clues are a couple of bullets in his back and a Swiss bank account number on microfilm surgically implanted in his hip. He goes to the Swiss bank and finds a safe deposit box, which contains lots of cash, a gun, and several passports with his photo but different names. In this scene, he's talking to a woman played by Franca Potente, who is helping him find his way.
Who has a safety deposit box full of money and six passports and a gun? Who has a bank account number in their hip?
I come in here, and the first thing I'm doing is I'm catching the sight lines and looking for an exit.
I see the exit sign too. I'm not worried. I mean, you were shot. People do all kinds of weird and amazing stuff when they're scared.
I can tell you the license plate numbers of all six cars outside. I can tell you that our waitress is left-handed and the guy sitting up at the counter weighs 215 pounds and knows how to handle himself. I know the best place to look for a gun is the cab of the gray truck outside. And at this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking. Now, why would I know that? How can I know that and not know who I am?
Since the character of Jason Bourne doesn't know who he is and isn't very talkative, Matt Damon had to rely on Bourne's physical bearing to get into character. Damon trained in boxing and martial arts in preparation.
You know, I try to get at least 3 months of prep time to just try to live the life that the character that I'm playing lives, and I'm really selfish about that time, and it's like my time, and it's usually the best part of the experience is the research, because nobody else is around, and I'm kind of allowed to go as far afield as I want to, and it changes with every project.
You had to get bigger and stronger for this movie and look like you were comfortable with guns and beating people up and so on. But for other movies, you've had to diminish a little bit. Like for The Talented Mr. Ripley, you got thinner,
right,
and had to look more physically uncomfortable in your body.
Right.
And for Courage Under Fire, you had to lose a lot of weight and you know, look unhealthy. Is it ever alienating to see your body as an instrument that you're constantly having to change? You know, that whole mind-body disconnect?
Yeah.
So, like, when your mind is always telling your body that it has to change, is that ever alienating?
Yeah, it's just, it can be frustrating because all that work that goes into it, you know, as I was saying, it's, you know, something that I love to do, but it's also really lonely, especially when you're doing things like losing, you know, weight like that. And that was actually, I think, something that kind of going back to that time I like to take before a movie, that's something that really, really helps me, because I think, you know, the situation like Ripley, where I was running a lot and not eating a lot and was physically uncomfortable, combined with the fact that I was playing piano, and I'm by nature, I'm not a musician. It was very frustrating and very lonely to be sitting there and playing the piano for all those hours for months. It affected the way that I sat. It affected the way that I walked, and it really affected kind of, I think, you know, emotionally, the way that I was really starved for kind of human connection, which is very much at the center of that character and the acceptance that he's longing for. And I think in some way, it, like, just those months of preparing and of doing those things that he would have done really, really informed the performance.
You know, I read that for Courage Under Fire, when you had to lose weight, you not only starved yourself, but you used laxatives. Now, that can't be very healthy.
Actually, laxatives I used after I started eating again, because I did it unsupervised, and so all I was doing was I would run 13 miles every day, and I would eat chicken and egg whites and vegetables and 1 to 2 baked potatoes every day for my carbohydrates. But I would run 6.5 miles in the morning and then 6.5 at night. And by the end of it, when my body really started kind of eating itself, like eventually your muscle just starts, you're consuming muscle at the end. There's no fat left really to consume. And I was just so tired. I just remember I would wake up in the morning. I would sit up in my bed. We were in Austin, Texas shooting, and I would immediately fall back over because I would get faint. So that was how I was working out at the end. I mean, it was stupid, and it was unsupervised, and I was low down on the totem pole. The studio wasn't going to spend, you know, $1,500 for me to have a trainer. I mean, but I also knew that it was a chance for me to get more work if I played the role, if I was honest and true in the role, then somebody would take notice. Anybody, you know.
Did Robert De Niro create this thing where, like, after Raging Bull, you had to put on weight or take off weight or physically change in some amazing way?
I'm sure he. I mean, I grew up, you know, with that, seeing Raging Bull and loving that performance in that movie. And, you know, and I was 25 when I did Courage Under Fire, and it was, you know, the young man's kind of swagger and saying, look, you know, this is what I'm willing to do. This is what I'll put my body through. This is what, because the people that you really, you know, idolize did it too. And it's also this kind of weird, you know, living out in Los Angeles and not being able to get acting work. You know, it's a weird way of saying, you know, no matter what happens, nobody's ever going to tell me that there's anybody out here with more discipline or who will give up more for, you know, will sacrifice more for their job than me. And I don't
know.
So
what'd you get for it?
What's that?
What'd you get for it, for all this sacrifice?
Sick. I got sick. And, you know, eventually when I went back to Boston, the doctor put me on 2 different kinds of medication, and he said I'd really done some bad things to my body. He checked me out, and the first thing he said was, the only good thing I can tell you is that your heart didn't shrink.
Jeez.
And then he told
That's
me I could
option?
Never do it again.
Wow.
Yeah, well, it's your heart's a muscle, so if I'd kept up with it, you know, obviously that's what happens to people with anorexia, and, you know, eventually their bodies just shut down. So what my, you know, my big master plan of having people take notice, the movie came out, and I was living in Somerville, Massachusetts with Ben and his brother Casey, and we were hoping that Good Will Hunting was going to get going. We'd written it already. Mm-hmm. It had been sold to Castle Rock and then gone into Turnaround and was at Miramax. And we moved back to Boston with the expectation that we were going to make the movie. And it got stalled and, you know, studio politics and all that stuff. And it didn't look like it was getting made. And I was on this medication, and the reviews for Courage Under Fire came out, and none of them mentioned me at all. And that was when I just said, you know what, this is ridiculous, you know. But it was heartbreaking for me. It was really heartbreaking.
Matt Damon is my guest, and he's starring in the new movie, The Bourne Identity, which is based on the Robert Ludlum spy novel. As we mentioned, you studied martial arts for the movie and gunplay and all that. And you do a lot of fighting in this,
a lot of
self-defense and offense as well. Now, I read that your mother, who is a child developmental psychologist, do I have that right?
Early childhood development, a professor of early childhood development.
No, I read that she has always been opposed to, like, war toys and playing with guns
Very
and things
much
like
so,
that.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you having been brought up in that kind of environment where you're discouraged from playing with guns, and now professionally what you have to do is pretend like you're really good at fighting?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting... you know, my mom saw the movie the other day, you know, it's definitely not her type of movie. I mean, I don't think she's ever seen an action movie, so I don't think she could compare it to anything. But what gets her, actually, one of our family friends came walking up to her after and jokingly said, that's what you get for not letting your kids play with guns. but seriously, she, you know, in terms of movies, she's most upset about the rating system.
That it's sex and not violence, or...
The entertainment violence, what they call the entertainment violence, and then there's no one to really, police it, because obviously the exhibitors aren't going to turn away people who are showing up with money, and the studios want as many people to see it as possible. So it's hard to create, it's hard to figure out a way to legislate against, you know, kids seeing stuff that they shouldn't see.
Is she angry at you for doing an action film?
Well, I tried to explain to her that this is, you know, I'm going, Mom, it's more like a European movie. It's a character-driven action movie. And she got it. I mean, she, you know, I think she thought it should have been rated R, you know. Her opinion of The Bourne Identity was, you know, that it should have been rated R. And when we were talking about the themes and the...
As opposed to PG-13,
right,
which is what it got.
Right. And it, when we were talking about the themes and all the this guy's sense for his search for who he is, and at the end when, you know, what the choice that he makes and how he's, you know, searching for redemption and kind of the only place that he can, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of dark and it's kind of, you know, it doesn't vindicate him, and you know, we were talking and she said, well, these are adult themes, and then that's, you know, why the movie should be rated R, and it just sent her into a whole thing about the rating system in general. Because we like, for instance, in All the Pretty Horses, when I did that movie, there's this very graphic scene in which I stab a guy in prison. The movie got a PG-13 rating. And my mom was saying at the time it should have had a PG-15 rating. Like, if there was... But I was advocating for it to get a PG-13 rating, and I wrote a letter, which I don't know if Miramax ever sent to Jack Valenti, but I wrote him a very long letter describing... you know, there are two murders that occur in that movie. One occurs off screen. It's the killing of Blevins, which is, you know, signified by a gunshot that happens off screen. And the other one is this stabbing, which is a very intense, very hysterical and violent act. But that the next hour of the movie, or what should have been the next hour, it was probably the next 10 minutes in the studio's version, was this guy trying to come to grips with both these violent acts. And so, at any rate, so Mom's point isn't that there shouldn't be violence in movies. Violence is a part of the human condition, and it's not to be ignored. And movies are about conflict at the end of the day. But it just has to be handled in a way in which, you know, you see the consequences for...
Were you able to see action films or horror films when you were growing up?
Yeah, yeah, and loved them. Yeah,
she had no problem with that, or you
no,
just did it
didn't.
In spite of
it. I think she tried to encourage our taste and encourage our play. And, you know, for instance, you know, she would give us very open ended tools to, you know, play with, whatever, blocks or something, or build your own, whatever. And from a very early age, my brother, who's now a sculptor and a painter, he's a terrific artist. But when we were kids, he would make costumes for me. And I derived pleasure out of acting out what these things were. So my mother claims that from a very early age, she knew that he was an artist and I was an actor.
My guest is Matt Damon. He's starring in the new film, The Bourne Identity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Matt Damon is my guest, and he's now starring in the spy film, The Bourne Identity, which is based on a Robert Ludlum novel. Now, you met Ben Affleck when you were about 10. Did he want to act too? I mean, was the desire to act part of the basis of your friendship?
Definitely. Well, he was acting. He was known in Cambridge as the professional actor, because he was on this PBS series called The Voyage of the Mimi, which was an educational TV show that was on PBS, and they use it as a tool in schools. And so as far as everyone in our neighborhood was concerned, he was a huge movie star, and he was like a, you know... And so Ben was probably in the Screen Actors Guild when he was 8, you know.
Wow.
We lived 2 blocks from each other, but we really became friends in high school when he got to high school. So I was 15 or 16 when he got there, and he was 14. And then we fashioned, yeah, a very, very deep bond, and a lot of it was based on what we both wanted to do. I mean, it's a weird thing looking back. And going and meeting 16-year-olds or meeting 14-year-olds, you know, and at the age of 31, and going, God, that was what he and I were flying to New York together at that age. Because my parents didn't support the idea that I would do this professionally at that age. They didn't say that I couldn't do it. They never did things like that. But they said they wouldn't pay for me to go to New York to audition for things. And so I did a local commercial in Boston. Ben and I went and got cast in a local commercial in Boston.
Wait, I'm going to interject. I think it was a TJ Maxx commercial.
Yeah, it was.
Get the Max for the minimum.
The Max for the minimum at TJ Maxx. And we got cut out of the commercial, but we still got paid.
Did you have to sing or try on coats or
no,
what?
I forget. I think we were sitting at a cafeteria table and a pretty girl walked by and we had to look at her and then look at each other like, isn't it great to be back in school or something like that. It was like a back to school ad.
Oh.
But we opened up a bank account with and put the money in and we called it like, you know, our business bank account. But the money was for trips to New York for, you know, on the old Pan Am shuttle or on the train.
So what did you do on that first trip to New York?
First trip to New York. First time I went to New York with Ben was to meet his agent. He had an agent mm-hmm. at a little Ma and Pa agency in New York that I remember, you know, I remember like it was yesterday, flying to New York and getting to New York and being overwhelmed. And Ben was really the leader in that because I'd never been to New York, certainly not, you know. I'd never been there for one, and I'd never been many places without parental supervision. So to be walking around the streets of New York with your best friend, and you know, we just felt like the kings of the world. And then went in, and I remember being very nervous in meeting with this agent, and they signed me, you know, which luckily didn't amount to anything over the next 3 years that I was with them, or 2 years that I was represented by them. I don't think, you know, I probably had 3 or 4 auditions. But I felt like, you know, I had people in New York, you know, and so I think that calmed me down and allowed me to kind of focus on school and more important, you know, in retrospect, social things that had a far bigger influence on the actor that I am now.
So you got an agent and you felt like really hot stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. did you brag a lot to your friends?
Ben and I just were probably so aloof when we were that, you know, we used to have what we called business lunches, and we would sit there and, I mean, say things. I mean, just sit down and go, so how's business? You know, I mean, we didn't have anything to talk about, but I think it was just, you know, a few years of sitting there and you know, having these kind of faux serious lunches, you know, I guess we just talked about, you know, someday we'll get good roles and we'll get, you know, we're not going to be sitting in this cafeteria forever.
Were you involved in high school drama productions?
Yeah, very heavily. Both of us were. And we had an incredible teacher named Jerry Specca, who's just, you know, like an angel as far as we're concerned. And a lot of the plays he wrote, the way in which he wrote actually is the same way that Ben and I wrote Good Will Hunting. It's heavily, you know, it's all about improvisation. And mm-hmm. He would kind of collect all that stuff and somehow make it into a coherent play.
You ended up going to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Cambridge, so that wasn't far to go,
right.
Far to go intellectually, but not geographically.
Right.
And then you left, I think, during or before your senior year.
Yeah.
To work.
Yeah, I left a few times. I left in the second semester of my sophomore year to do a TNT movie, and then I came back, and then left to do School Ties, and then came back again. And then left to do a movie called Geronimo. Geronimo.
I'm one of the few people who saw that.
Oh, you're the one, yeah. which was a great experience.
Walter Hill,
yeah. And that was a great experience. I mean, I got to work with Duvall and, you know, Gene Hackman. I didn't really get to work with Gene Hackman, but, you know, I shook his hand and I said, he said, what's your name? And I said, Matt Damon. He said, Mark, great to meet you. but Jason Patrick also, who's a really, really incredibly disciplined actor and a very serious guy, and was really good for me to meet at that age, because I was 22 or 23, and had I been exposed to somebody who wasn't as disciplined and severe a guy, I was prone to idolizing these people because they were doing what I wanted to do. And I probably would have followed, somebody who was less disciplined, you know, down a
right.
silly path.
One of the first theatrically released films that you were in was Mystic Pizza, in which you had, I think, one line?
One line.
Do you remember the line?
Yeah, it was, Mom, you want my green stuff.
Right. Okay. So now there are many different ways you could say that. I'm sure you wanted to make as big an impression as possible with that one line. What did you do to prepare for this one line, or to figure out exactly what your line reading was going to be, to try to make it count as much as possible?
We were eating lobster in the scene, and it was supposed to be Julia Roberts was coming back to dinner and to meet, you know, her rich boyfriend's family, and I was her rich boyfriend's little brother. And we're all eating this big lobster dinner, and it's just the family making small talk at the beginning of the scene. And I say, "Mom, you want my green stuff," meaning the tamale in the lobster. And the line was actually, "Mom, do you want my black stuff?" The line in the original script was, "Mom, do you want my black stuff?" And I remember I probably said, "Mom, do you want my black stuff?" in my room about, you know, 1,000 times before I drove down to Mystic with my mother. And when I got there, they had, you know, changed the line to, "Mom, you want my green stuff?" And I remember being thrown for a second. And then I went, "Wait a minute. This doesn't change anything." I just remember that experience being like, you know, just really, just the rose-colored lenses just couldn't have been more on. I mean, it was 3 nights. I was surrounded by these cameras and this crew that was really nice and all these actors, and I just remember thinking, "My God, if I could ever do this," you know, it just was overwhelming.
Matt Damon is starring in the new film, The Bourne Identity. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Matt Damon. He's starring in the new spy thriller, The Bourne Identity. In 1998, Damon and his longtime friend Ben Affleck won an Oscar for their screenplay for Good Will Hunting. Damon was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the film as Will, a young man from South Boston who works as a janitor at Harvard, but is able to solve seemingly unsolvable math problems left on a blackboard. Will grew up in foster homes and has a rap sheet. When he's jailed for instigating a fight, a professor who sees Will's genius bails him out on the condition that he gets some counseling. Will's psychologist is played by Robin Williams. In this scene, Will is in the psychologist's office when a painting catches his eye, a painting made by the psychologist.
The linear and impressionistic mix makes a very muddled composition. It's also a Winslow Homer ripoff, except you got Whitey rowing a boat there.
Well, it's an odd one, eh? It wasn't very good.
That's not really what concerns me, though.
What concerns you?
It's the coloring.
You know what the real bitch of it is? It's paint by number.
Is it color by number? Because the colors are fascinating to me.
Are they really? What about that?
I think you're about one step away from cutting your f***ing ear off.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think I should move to the south of France, change my name to Vincent.
You ever heard the saying, any port in a storm?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that means you.
In what way?
Maybe you're in the middle of a storm, a big f***ing storm.
Yeah.
The sky's falling on your head, the waves are crashing over your little boat, the oars are about to snap. You're just pissing your pants, you're crying for the harbor, so maybe you do what you gotta do to get out. You know, maybe you became a psychologist.
Bingo. That's it. Let me do my job now. You start with me. Come on.
Maybe you married the wrong woman.
Maybe you should watch your mouth.
Watch it right there, Chief, all right?
That's it, isn't it? You married the wrong woman? What happened? Why'd she leave you? Was she, you know, banging some other guy?
If you ever disrespect my wife again, I will end you. I will f***ing end you.
Let's get to Good Will Hunting. The movie, I think, is based on a play that you wrote when you were still a student at Harvard. What was the original play like?
I wrote it actually. It was a playwriting course that this guy Anthony Kubiak taught at Harvard, which is a terrific course and a great course. And he was an incredible teacher. And I wrote it as a screenplay because I knew that I wanted to write screenplays and I didn't want to write plays. So I wrote it, you know, in screenplay format. And the original one was 41 pages long, and it just had the beginnings of a story, and it had, from what survived of it was the one scene that survived from that was was the first time that I meet Robin Williams' character in that movie, when he eventually grabs me by the neck and throws me up against the wall because I say something about his wife. And that scene was verbatim as I wrote in Tony's, in Anthony Kubiak's class. But nothing else, nothing else survived. But he encouraged me, the teacher encouraged me when I finished the class. He gave me an A, and it was the first, you know, one of the first times I got an A at Harvard. And I didn't care what I got in the class. I had had such a good time in the class, and he gave me an A. And next to it, he wrote on the paper, he wrote, you know, you should really keep going with this. This really seems like it could be leading somewhere, and encouraged me to do it. And so a few months later, for spring break, I went to Los Angeles to audition, actually, for Geronimo, an American legend, and stayed with Ben and brought the you know, work in progress thing with me and showed him, and he loved it. And he said, this is great. We should do something with this. And so we agreed. You know, neither of us knew which way to go with it, though. So a little later on, I did Geronimo and then moved in. Ben and I got a place in L.A. with Casey, his brother. And we were there for like a year before, you know, and this thing was just sitting on the shelf because neither of us could think of what to do. And then one night we were literally sitting around talking. It was probably 1 a.m. and it just started. I think Ben was the first one. He started saying something. And the way that things normally work with us is one person says a little thing, the next person, and it just starts to rapidly, which is why, you know, we're utterly useless without each other. At least we have been so far. But it happened really, and it kind of tumbled out, and the script came really, really quickly.
So after you made Good Will Hunting and like doors really started to open for you, what was it like for you to suddenly have access to the things you wanted? People wanted you to act in their movies.
Yeah, it was weird. It was really weird and overwhelming in that sense, in a really good way. To have, you know, Anthony Minghella cast me in Ripley before Good Will Hunting even came out. He saw the rough cut and assembly of the movie, and I just couldn't believe that he wanted to put. I couldn't, you know, I read his script, you know, because he did the adaptation. And I just couldn't, you know, it was just overwhelming. I said, somebody's going to let me play this character? I mean, this is an incredible role in an incredible movie with this director who's, you know, a serious guy. I mean, he's, you know, his shooting schedule was like a 94-day shooting schedule. You know, we shot Goodwill in half that, you know, you know, it was just overwhelming to be getting all this work that I thought was really good work.
I want to ask you about the talented Mr. Ripley. You were really just terrific in that film. And you're playing somebody who doesn't have any of the things he wants: friends, a lover, interesting work, interesting life, travel, money,
right.
None of that. And through a little bit of deception, or perhaps a lot of deception, he's able to kind of change his life and become part of this like charmed circle of wealthy people,
right,
revolving particularly around this one couple played by Jude Law and
right.
Gwyneth Paltrow. And the first time you meet them, you're meeting them, is it in Italy?
Yeah.
And you're on the Mediterranean on a beach, and they're all like bronzed and beautiful, and you've just arrived from
New York City.
Yeah, and you're pale and kind of scrawny. This is one of the
right.
roles you lost weight for. And the first time you meet them, you're in your bathing suit, and you just look so wrong.
Right.
You look so out of place. And it sets the tone beautifully for everything that's to follow, this physically uncomfortable, out-of-the-place, wrong-looking person. Can you talk a little bit just about that scene even, and setting the tone with looking kind of frail and pale and...
Yeah, I just thought it
exposed.
Was exposed. Yeah, it was right for. It was just right. I mean, it was right there in the script when I read it, and it made total sense. And we wanted obviously when Ripley starts to try to take over Dickie's identity, for him to try to look more and more like him. So the bigger gap you can leave at the beginning, the better that's going to come across. And also, we just love the awkwardness of it. You know, the green bathing suit. That I wore was, you know, maybe a little bit kind of over the top. There was a scene, though, that Anthony had scripted just in case he felt we needed it, where they show me buying the bathing suit. I see him on the beach, and so I buy the bathing suit, and that's the only one they have, which is how I ended up with that bathing suit, just in case it seemed too kind of goofy that I would have a lime green, you know, bathing suit. But you know, Anthony looked at the movie and didn't feel like we needed it, and so, you know, so there's Ripley kind of showing up as pale. I mean, they painted me alabaster for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You got painted pale.
Yeah, and I already was pale. I had stayed out of the sun for, you know, months and months, and I was as pale as I could be, but they you know, even put more kind of gook all over me.
What did you do internally to get into the character of somebody who wants so desperately to live this life that he has no access to, that he finally ends up not only deceiving but killing for it?
It's just that I can really relate. I really related to that character in a lot of ways. I really related to
in,
that.
In what way?
I don't know. I've had that feeling, you know, in my life of wanting to belong somewhere and not belonging and yeah. I mean, I've definitely felt that, and especially kind of in, you know, adolescence and teenage years. I mean, those are, you feel that with such pain and, you know.
Yeah, but you already had an agent in New York.
Yeah, right, that's
you
right.
You can brag about to your friends.
Yeah, God. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot to him that to that character that I just really related to and loved. I still feel bad for that character. I got really mad the first time I saw the movie, actually, with the final music, because there was a scene where I'm walking at Gwyneth and I have a razor in my pocket, and the music that, you know, which it's perfect for the movie, it's right for the movie, but because Anthony was my kind of, you know, partner in crime, that the whole time we were shooting it, every time something, you know. We would ask something, you know, we'd say, well, should Ripley, I mean, I'd say, so I'm going to kill Freddy with this statue? And he'd go, of course you're going to kill Freddy. Freddy's coming into your house. Freddy is accusing you of doing it. How dare he? He has a lot of nerve. You know, he was very much my ally, you know, when we were shooting it, because that was what got me, you know, ready for every scene was the fact that what I'm doing makes total sense. Of course I'm going to do this, and this makes... you know, so Anthony was a very good kind of sounding board for the Ripley rationale, but of course, at the end of the day, he's the director of the movie. So when he goes to put the music over the scene where I'm walking towards Gwyneth with a razor blade, he's not defending Ripley. He's got this kind of Hitchcockian music over it. And so when I saw it, I was like, you know, how, you know.
He told me I was justified.
Yeah, exactly. How dare you? You're supposed to be my friend.
My guest is Matt Damon. Here he is in the film The Talented Mr. Ripley. In order to impress his new friend, who's a jazz musician, Ripley's tried to learn to sing like Chet Baker. In this scene, he's sitting in at a jazz club.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak when you open it to speak? Are you smart?
We'll talk more with Matt Damon after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Matt Damon. He's starring in the new spy thriller, The Bourne Identity. I'd like to ask you about some of the advice you've gotten from different directors over the years. If we could just, like, walk through a couple of the directors that you work with. You, Billy Bob Thornton directed you on All the Pretty Horses. Now, I know you've said that the movie was really
butchered
in the post-production process because of the studio. I actually like the film. I wish I could see the uncut or the director's cut. But what kind of advice did Billy Bob Thornton give you?
If you
remember.
Well, no, I remember. You know, Billy Bob had a huge impact on me. He's a pretty amazing guy, and a really amazing guy. You know, we're friends, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. so, you know, sometimes you meet, you know, directors who just kind of, you know, they talk a lot, and they talk, you know, they talk you to death, and they and it's not really helpful,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, sometimes a lot of talk is, you know, can be helpful, you know, but more often than not, it's just somebody saying something simple. And Billy had this tendency to be able to not only do that, but then to recognize when you did something very, very small, very subtle. And oftentimes actors get frustrated because there are things that happen that that the director doesn't see, and they don't understand that. And you know when you're really feeling something. You absolutely know.
Mm-hmm.
And the directors can miss it, you know, but Billy Bob, I never saw him miss it. He certainly never missed it with me. He would do stuff like we'd be in the first take of a scene and something would happen really small and not the biggest thing in the world, just a little scene about, you know, a guy coming in a building or whatever, you know, just a small thing. And he'd go, all right, cut, print, we're moving on. And the producer would go, wait a minute, we got to do another one for safety. What if it was out of focus? And he'd say, if it's out of focus, it's out of focus in the movie. That was real. I saw what happened there, and I'm not doing it again. And you know, as an actor, you have a director like that kind of, you know, you'll do anything for
it. Right. What was it like for you when you first became, when you first started acting in movies with big stars in it, and then you became a big star yourself, and suddenly all the people who you admired when you were young, who seemed so out of reach, who lived either in the television box or on the big screen, were colleagues of yours or friends of yours or people you had access to. Was it awkward at first to be in that circle, to be in that situation where people who were always just these like movie figures were now actually three-dimensional people, and you were working with them or you were talking with them?
Yeah, yeah, that was weird. I mean, the only time I really run into other people, you know, that I've grown up watching or whatever is at like a ceremony or, you know, an event or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't really run into too many people, although I have an assistant, and I guess, you know, for two years ago for Christmas, I guess I have a habit of talking about Morgan Freeman a lot because I really respect Morgan
Freeman. Oh, he's great, yeah.
And so this is going to sound really silly, but for Christmas a couple of years ago, she gave me as a Christmas gift dinner with Morgan Freeman. She called Morgan Freeman's assistant, and I guess he thought it was funny, and so they kind of agreed, and it was like a, you know, make-a-wish dinner or something where I, you know, it was like, you know, Chris Farley on the old Chris Farley show on Saturday Night Live. Like, remember that time in that movie when you did that thing? That was awesome. So that was an interaction I had with somebody that was, but for the most part, the most I get to know people is working with them. And I've been incredibly lucky to, you know, starting with, you know, back with Duvall, how good he was to me, and how he didn't have to do that, and the guy is a living legend, you know, and he tolerated my questions, and I did Courage Under Fire with Denzel Washington, and he was really nice to me, and what came next was Rainmaker. I mean, God damn, Danny DeVito, Mickey Rourke was great to me. Mickey Rourke sat me down the first time I met him, kind of forcefully, and said, "Don't screw this up. Don't do what I did. I was a jerk to people. I you know." Right. He said, "You appreciate what you have, and be polite to everybody you meet, and don't ever screw this up." It was pretty, you know, affecting. You know,
right. Just one last question. I know you get really deep into roles, and you can become very obsessive about it, and you've spent just like a lot of time getting to where you are in movies. Are you going through the kind of thing that so many of us go through about what is the right balance between work and everything else in life?
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely haven't figured it out yet. Mm-hmm. And I definitely, because I'm desperately afraid of ever not really, you know, the next role that I do, of not really committing to it and diving into it just because suddenly I have a life that I really care about. I hope, you know, I've heard say, people like Anthony Hopkins in interviews say that, you know, he doesn't work as hard as he worked when he was younger because he knows, you know, because of the knowledge, you can suddenly streamline your kind of energy, your output of energy, because you know what helps and what really doesn't. And you know that because you've been doing it for your entire life. So he can be brilliant and not put out, you know, the energy that he would have had to 30 right. years ago. You know, I'm hoping that's a factor later on, because I do want to have, you know, a life, and I do want to travel and have a family someday and keep doing this. But, you know, I have this weird obsessive thing where I wonder if I've done everything that I possibly could. It's almost like obsessive compulsive disorder or something. Or maybe just to prove to myself, maybe just so I won't regret it. And it's like, I'll get out of bed in the middle of the night and go read something or go do something or get on the internet and go research this one last thing. And just, you know, it's probably not healthy.
But it makes for a good performance.
Sometimes.
Matt Damon, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for having me.
Matt Damon is starring in the new film, The Bourne Identity. This is Fresh Air.